The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyad.
My name is Michael Guyad, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the hour is the man who coined the term FANG, from what I've read, Bob Lang, who I'm sure many of you have also seen doing media rounds over the last several years here. Bob, introduce yourself to the audience. Who are you? What's your background? How'd you get involved in interested in markets? And did you get any royalty checks?
I wish I did, Michael, but it's great to be with you. And you know, first of all, I just want to say thank you for doing all these spaces and podcasts and so forth. It's extremely informative. I've heard nothing but great things about you and what you do to bring information to everyone, because it's so difficult to make choices and decisions when it comes to trading and investing. But you know, we all need to become smarter and become better, and I think that's what you do, and in helping people. And so, you know, thank you for doing that from me, and hopefully from most of the audience.
I appreciate that.
Sure. So anyway, a little bit about me, Michael. I trade options. I've been an options trader for a long while, and I've started services back in the mid 2000s for another company, and then started my own company back in 2011, Explosive Options. And started a chat room up, and I've been trading options for over 20 years, and from the long side, from the short side, and so forth. Wrote a book about options called Know Your Options, and I really tried to, similar to what you do, is trying to dumb things down and make things easier for people to understand on how to make money trading options. I think options trading, Michael, is a very difficult thing for people to do and difficult thing for people to understand, because not only do you have to get the direction right, but you also have to get the timing correct. And I think most people are used to getting the direction right. Being long the markets for a long period of time has been a winning investment, winning trade for the most part. But you can't always be long when you're in options, in trading. You can't always be long calls. You can be long puts and so forth like that. So I've cut my teeth and made all the mistakes probably several times that anybody can make. And probably I'm still making more of them. I'm discovering new mistakes to make, but that's fine. It's all, every day is a new learning experience for me. And really enjoy sharing what my knowledge and what I do to help people sidestep some of the mistakes that I've made over the years.
I'm glad you make that point about direction versus timing. That's sort of an offshoot of a line I keep saying, which is that path matters more than prediction, right? It's not about the endpoint. It's about how you get there, which is entirely around timing and kind of the sequence of returns. It's curious to me that you mentioned that you started the company in 2011, which is the year everybody is referencing as far as what's going on with the debt ceiling back and forth that's happening now. Take us back to that time period. Are there real parallels to the summer crash of 2011, the setup prior to that? We know it was largely because S&P did that credit downgrade, but what is reminiscent of that prior period of stress, not just in markets, but obviously when it comes to options and volatility?
Well, I think, Michael, the similarity there is that volatility. We did see volatility rise up sharply later that year. I want to say that debt downgrade came in August of 2011, just a few months after I got my company started in May. I think it's interesting the similarities that people are talking about today versus back then. We're not seeing as much stress today in the bond market as we did back then, and we're not seeing as much stress in the dollar today as we did back then. So I think those are two stark differences. And I think that at the end of the day, I think people really understand and they believe that this debt ceiling is going to get resolved by the probably in an 11th hour agreement. So I think for the most part, the hysteria and the hype that is being built on this debt ceiling crisis here is done from the media and you know, just to scare everybody into submission or scare everybody into doing something that they shouldn't be doing. And that's probably, you know, selling, just paying attention to the market action. You know, if you didn't have this, if you had blinders on, you didn't have all this stuff going on around you with this debt ceiling and some of these other things going on. If you just went through with your blinders on, you see something happening in the markets that without those distractions, and you probably could make better choices, better decisions.
Yeah, I think there's an argument to be made that the reason it seems that markets are not moving very much is because there's already a lot of hedging and activity that's gone on kind of beneath the surface. I've had a lot of people argue that markets are kind of pinned in terms of the bulls and the bears, so that's why we're not kind of moving very much. What do you think it would take to cause either a breakout or a breakdown? And I say breakout and breakdown purposely. I mean, small caps are at the lower end of the range, Russell 2000. Large caps are at the upper end of the range. Somebody's going to be wrong there.
So I think it's something that we aren't seeing right now happening. Right? Nobody really, up until about a few weeks prior to that Silicon Valley Bank blow up, nobody really saw what was going on or was really, you know, privy to information to telling people. I think there's a lot of, you know, if you go back and do a postmortem of that whole exercise, you could see a lot of the cracks that were being made back in February of this year, and even maybe a little bit earlier. So I think it, Michael, is probably something that we don't really know. And this is the true black swan is the one that you know, people don't see coming. Of course, you know, back in 2020, we had the big drop in the markets when the pandemic started. And I think we knew the pandemic was going to happen. We just didn't know the effects on the economy, the stock market, the global economy back then in 2020. So that's why people just said, you know what, get me out. And then we had everybody heading for the exits in March of 2020. They pushed the markets down. Interestingly enough, we rallied all the way back thanks to the Fed. And I think that next time around, Michael, I don't think the Fed is going to be there to save the markets and like they did last time and like they did in 2008, 2009 in the great financial crisis. I could be wrong. But I just don't think that that's going to happen again. I think there's something on the horizon there. I don't know what it is. I think everybody knows a recession is coming, Michael. And when people already know things are going to happen, there's no surprises there. And this, which is why, you know, we have volatility trading so low as it is right now.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Until we don't. I mean, I think that's kind of the point of volatility. It's notoriously mean reverting. You know, low vol can happen for a while and then have these spikes. That's why on average volatility, I think on the VIX, the average VIX is like 19.1 over time. But since you mentioned black swan, I wonder if it's more of a gray swan. I've continuously hammered this point about lumber, housing, consumers, everything kind of giving the same message alongside small caps. I saw the tweet I shared at the top of the nest about your Twitter on Home Depot earnings, indicative of a bigger problem in the economy. First of all, what is that bigger problem? And could that be sort of the thing that really gets volatility moving?
I think people are running out of money. And I also think that the jobs report, which has been strong for the past, you know, 18 months, I think it's going to start, you know, we always look at the jobs report with an enormous lag. There's a enormous lag. And I've been saying for a while that I think the worst jobs reports are going to be coming out in September and October of this year. So we're only 3 or 4 months out from now. I think you're going to see drawdowns in job creation. You're going to see minus, you know, 100, 200,000 job creations just because I think companies are going to be a little bit more cautious, tighten their belts a little bit. And I think a lot of these layoffs that we've seen over the past couple of months, they're going to start catching up. And, you know, you're going to see these jobless claims starting to explode. I think they've started to creep up a little bit. So these are little clues along the way that I think are going to have a huge effect on what's happening. I think people are slowing down. I know that there's a lot of talk about a housing shortage. I get it. But, you know, I live out here in New England, Michael, near Boston, and the housing prices are out of control. And I'm just hearing on the news the other day that, you know, people are coming in to like Las Vegas, houses that are selling for $300,000-$400,000. There are multiple bids going on, and then $400,000-$500,000 homes, they're going above those prices. This harkens back to 2008-2009 great financial crisis, where people were overbidding for houses that they couldn't afford, and that led to such a huge crisis back then. But I think that people are running out of money. And retail sales this morning kind of showed that.
Yeah, and I go back to, you know, housing is a far more important asset than any single stock anybody buys and owns, because the vast majority of, you know, wealth is in one's home. So, you know, the fact that Home Depot is kind of giving you that message, lumber's confirming it, small caps, which are more sensitive to the domestic economy, keep on underperforming, it's more than just the regional banks. It's interesting that that narrative is not getting pushed out there. And presumably that narrative is not getting pushed out there because, you know, you look at the headline averages and, you know, it's a pretty good year so far, right? When you look at the S&P and the NASDAQ in particular. Since you mentioned that point about kind of great financial crisis parallel, I mean, obviously we know that the dynamics on lending are different. But I keep going back to, I think there's an underappreciation for how you could get this butterfly effect from people that bought second, third, fourth homes, used Airbnb to monetize those homes, and then now may have a real breakdown in rental income, right, from people that are using those homes. What do you think about this idea that this housing inventory narrative is just wrong, that it gets solved very quickly with some panic sells?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that shadow economy that you're talking about, you know, where people buy a second home in Airbnb, I don't think it's a very sustainable business model. I think for some people, you know, it's good, but for most people, it's not. And I don't think that's a model that that people can rely on for a long period of time, especially as interest rates stay elevated for a long period of time. That's what the Fed has been telling us. The interest rates are going to be elevated for higher for longer. That's their language, right? So, what does that mean? I mean, I look out at the yield curve and. I know the Fed funds futures are looking at rate cuts coming in later this year, maybe up to three by December. I look at the yield curve. I don't see any rate cuts coming in at least to at the earliest February or March of 2024, and then maybe one or two more at the end of 2024. So we're not talking about a receding amount of cost in terms of interest rates for people. So I think that's another thing that's, you know, people just can't afford to buy homes with interest rates where they're at. I think, you know, like myself, we're kind of stuck here because, you know, we have an interest rate that's about 2.5%. We locked that in a year and a half ago. Why should we move to pay a higher cost for a house, for a higher interest cost as well too? I mean, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So I think a lot of people are in the same position we are. They're not moving. That's why inventories are tight. But still, I think that this thing that you mentioned about the housing is very critical, and it's going to it could have some negligible effects on the economy. If the stock market's going to go higher, you've got to pay attention to valuation, right? And you got to pay attention to earnings. Is there earnings growth? Is there room to grow? Is the multiple for the market going to grow based on earnings growth? And I don't see that in 2023, we're going to see that earnings growth. And I do see that 2024 earnings estimates are far too rosy because interest rates, even though the market is predicting that we're going to probably get another maybe 150 basis points of rate cuts into middle of 2024, I don't think the market is right as a Fed funds futures market. I don't think the market is correct there. And I think trying to jump over that hurdle of 4.5% to 5% interest rates to produce good, strong earnings, that's going to compare to the return you're going to get on bonds. I think it's going to be a difficult hurdle here. And frankly, the more the stock market goes up and the higher that multiple gets, the closer it gets to the year of 1999, 2000. Michael, you remember that when earnings were the stock market was trading at, what, 26 times earnings? Don't think we're going to get up there again, but you never know. I mean, if the S&P 500 gets to old highs, maybe above 5,000 or something like that, we're going to be up in those nosebleed areas.
How do you think about those? Just speaking about that run-up, as I recall, in the lead-up to the March 2020 NASDAQ peak, you had a hell of a lot of narrowness in market leadership and breadth as most of the market started correcting before the NASDAQ blow-off peak. You know, it is remarkable how the headline averages, I would argue, are deceptive in their masking a lot of the weakness because a few select stocks, right, which goes back to the FANGs, kind of your term, in this case are really kind of holding the whole damn thing up. When you see narrowness, how do you interpret it? Do you say to yourself, well, you know, maybe small caps, they already took their hit, they're now bound to come back, all the other areas which lagged, you know, are due to have some kind of mean reversion on the upside, or... You know, is it the argument you often hear that the generals, you know, follow the soldiers, so to speak?
Yeah. So the narrowness of the market is troubling to me. I when I'm looking for maybe some kind of a bullish trend or even a bearish trend, I want to see broad participation. I want to see a lot of stocks moving in the direction of the trend. So the markets are going up. I want to see large participation. Now, if I look at the NASDAQ, for instance, Michael, that stocks above their 20-day moving average. In the NASDAQ, it's under 50%, right? So it tells me over the last 20 days, let's call it a month, you know, more than 50% of stocks are below that 20-day moving average. And that's really a signal of short-term momentum for stocks. And in fact, let me bring it up right now. It looks like we're at 46% of stocks right now that are above their 20-day moving average. So in the last month, NASDAQ 100 stocks, 54 of them are below their 20-day moving average. So that's not good solid breadth. That's not good solid price momentum or price action. We need to see more stocks participating to the upside to feel comfortable that we're getting a broad rally. We're getting a lot of participation from institutions that are coming in and buying a lot of different stocks, not just Apple or Amazon or Google or Meta or whatever. That narrowness of the market harkens back to a day when my dad was a stockbroker back in the 1970s, Michael. They talked about the Nifty 50 back then. You had Coca-Cola and Eastman Kodak and Polaroid and yada, yada, yada. So, I mean, there's a few stocks that were targeted by investors back then. And today, it's the same sort of thing. There's a few stocks that are targeted by investors. They call them hideouts, the places to hide their money out in. But eventually, they get smoked out and everybody takes a hit because the larger part of the market acts like an anchor to bring around the rest of the market. So I think that's a dangerous sign when you have a narrowness of the market like we have today.
Is there a chance that the that hideout factor is different this time? And I hesitate saying that, but I suspect that because there's so much hype around AI, I suspect that there's some money that's really positioning on that play, and that explains why it seems like we have two very different markets, right? The kind of mega cap tech plays that are the forefront of AI versus everything else. Do you think there's any validity to the idea that AI and sort of the hype there is maybe distorting markets even more?
Well, let me put it this way. Let me ask you this question, Michael. Is AI something that is life-changing for you, that is a game changer, that's going to make your life so much easier? You're going to live longer. You're going to get information faster and that sort of thing. My answer for me is no. How about you?
I think the jury is out. Okay, so I've been playing around actually with AI quite a bit the last couple of weeks. So even the tweet setup for this Twitter space was written by AI. Like, I didn't write that. I mean, I reviewed it, obviously. Same thing with the Twitter space title. I literally did it on the way back from the gym. Right. So does it save time? Is it useful? Yes. I'm a little hesitant to believe the excitement is going to be that long lasting. First of all, AI has been around for a while. It's not like this is like a brand new thing. It's just getting more out there, but it's been out there for a while. The bigger thing is, to me, the narratives are very reminiscent around the hype around 3D televisions. It's very reminiscent of the hype around the metaverse. All this, you know, it may end up being right, but the question is the timing, kind of going back to your point earlier.
Yeah, I remember you know, we probably both remember way back in the late 90s, that whole thing. Remember B2B and B2C, all that other stuff. It was like a $50 billion economic boom that's was going to happen, and it just fizzled. I'm not saying that AI is going to fizzle. I'm sure there's probably some use for it and some value for it. But I think it's I have a hard time believing that it's going to live up to the hype that it's been getting over the past several months. And like you said, it's been around for a while. Somebody, a friend of mine, put up a Forbes article from 1998 talking about artificial intelligence.
Right, I think, 1998, Peter Pukvar, right? I saw that from him, right?
That's right, Peter. That's right, Peter Pukvar put that up there. And 1990s—that's 25 years ago. I mean, come on. I mean, that was that was the last time Michael Jordan put his sneakers on and played on played basketball. So it's been a while. So, but it's been around for a while, as you said. I just don't know if you got to maybe cut it back by about 30% from the hype from what it is right now. And maybe there's some value there. Maybe these big companies like Meta and Google and Amazon and Microsoft are going to find some value. But I don't see any of these other smaller companies doing the same.
Yeah. And actually, there's echoes of, you know, if you remember back in the lead up to the, you know, tech bubble, companies would put .com after their company name just to cause a 20-30% spike in stock price. I mean, you saw some of that action, you know, with AI, not as long lasting, but, you know, there's some interesting parallels, I think, there too.
Yeah, I think I think more recently on some of these earnings calls last month, Michael, the more you said AI in the conference call, the higher your stock went.
Yeah, the more, you know, AI driven, I mean, algo, right? Saw that, it's like, yeah. Oh, I like this. You're talking about me.
Right? Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Okay, so let's step out a little bit further. Last year was, as I said many times, hell, because treasuries failed in what should have been a flight to safety dynamic of high volatility. Duration obviously was the source of volatility. It doesn't seem like we're fully out of the woods, even though the regional bank crisis, I'd argue, maybe brought some of that flight to safety dynamic back. But where are we in terms of just the state of diversification? And I know that sounds like a really odd question, but to me, diversification only matters when you need it the most, which is in high volatility, right? So do you suspect that we're kind of re-entering a normalized environment of the relationships of stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies to each other? Or are we still having the aftershocks of, you know, the insanity of last year?
Yeah, so, diversification, somebody once said, is the only free lunch you'll ever get on Wall Street. And I've been hearing a lot of talk recently about how the traditional 60-40 portfolio construction may be a thing of the past, and 60 equities, 40 fixed income. I think it's all dynamic. I think you all have to look at those things all at least once a year and say, you know, what's the appropriate balance that you should have based on where the economy is, where Fed policy is. I always do an inventory, Michael, at the end of the year. I have a list of criteria, list of things that I go over, check off the boxes one by one to see where am I going to be at the following year, right? And usually it's the end of December. I start ticking off these boxes and say, you know, are we in a bull market, a bear market? Where's the Fed? Yada, yada, yada. So all these things are so important for me to build a case for, you know, being more aggressive, being less aggressive, being more aggressive on the downside, whatever. As long as I have identified where I think the markets are at a certain point in time, and I can make adjustments through the year. But I think that what you're saying about fixed income, what's funny is that the Fed is selling bonds every single week, and they're trimming their balance sheet and doing what they're supposed to be doing, because their bloated balance sheet since 2020. Is out of control, but they're doing what they can do. But continually, we see bond prices going up. So it's interestingly because the Treasury continues to put out new issues of fixed income, and all these older fixed income products continue to come on the market. That, you know, via the Fed selling 5 years, 10 years, 20 years off their balance sheet, but still bond prices took up. So there's still a lot of demand for fixed income right now, even in 2023. So bond prices continue to go up, yields come down, and we still have that separation, that huge inversion of the curve. I'm not sure how long it's going to last, Michael, but it's really quite fascinating. Somebody's wrong, and somebody's going to win.
Do you get a sense that we're actually in a bull market, that the bear market ended on that, you know, October low or June low, depending upon, you know, what you're looking at. I'll tell you from my vantage point, as much as I keep saying it's pre-election year, which tends to be sort of a melt-up environment, I don't think the bear market's actually over. And I say that because if you look at that chart I've showed many times around top 20 drawdowns for equities against treasuries, one way to right the wrong of last year in terms of the way treasuries were down more than equities would be for equities to break the lows while treasuries maybe counter this time, which would be a degree of normalization in that flight to safety dynamic. But, you know, what are your thoughts on sort of this argument that the bear market is over?
I agree with you. I don't think the bear market is over. And I have one little signal that I like to use every month to tell me whether we're in a bear market or a bull market. And frankly, it's just a high level view, and it's just but it seems to work. You know, when I'm a technician, as you know, but the MACD on the monthly chart does when the thick line, the black line is underneath the red line, the thin line, we're in a bear market, and we've been for since last February, March, 2022. So when that crosses back over, and we're going to get a confirmation. So we could be 3 months out if the markets continue to go up, Michael, before the bull market restarts again. But so I still think we're in a bear market, like you say as well too. Further, you know, with interest rates where they are right now, I just have a hard time believing that a bear market can be over when the Fed is so aggressive with monetary policy. I've never seen it happen before. And frankly, one of the reasons why the stock market is hanging on is because of the strength in the jobs market. And so if that starts seeing some weakness, you know, look out, because I think it's gonna reflect on poor economic data going forward. We're already seeing some poor economic data. Yesterday, the Empire manufacturing data was horrendous. We've seen some other data showing some of the bad economic conditions that we had, other than housing, going on for the past couple of months. So I think you're right. I think we're still in a bear market right now. I think we're trapped in a range, 4,200 on the top side, 3,800 on the downside. And that's a narrow 10% range from where we started. We started at 3,800 at the beginning of the year, up to 4,200. We couldn't break through that in February. We tried a couple of times. We're close to it a couple of days ago. But now I think that it's going to be difficult to break through that range. And the vulnerability for the markets is to the downside.
By the way, if we were in that range for the next 10 years, that would be a bear market, because on a real return basis, right, you're sideways on a chart, but that's nominal prices. This is the other thing that I think people are not even considering. It's like, all right, you're looking at a chart that's going sideways, doesn't look that exciting. That's actually bearish in real inflation-adjusted terms.
So back in the 1970s, we had a couple of bear markets back in the 1970s. I was alive. I was very small, but I look at my history, pay attention to my history like you do. We had a couple of bear markets, and my definition of a bull market and bear market is different from other people. I look at a bull market as one that's going up, and I look at a bear market as one that's not going up. It doesn't have to be down. It could just be sideways, like you said. We go sideways for a while, it is going to frustrate everyone to no end. I mean, if you're not going up, you're not going down. Like you said, what if we were in that range? Let's just condense the time frame to 2023. What if the low end of the range is 3,800 and the high end is 4,200 all year long, and we're just trading in the middle of that range all year long? It's going to be super frustrating. People are going to worry that I can't make any money to the downside. I can't make any money to the upside. What am I going to do? So I think that's certainly a scenario we could be in this year, maybe even beyond this year.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Okay, so I want to go back to the start of the conversation, the point about, you know, direction versus timing. Full disclosure, I'm not a huge fan of options trading, only, and this is my own bias, just because I remember My father very clearly telling me, you know, never play with options because you're playing against time. And I get it. There's benefits to that. And some people obviously like you do it quite well. What are you doing just in terms of your own portfolio from an options trading perspective? I mean, you need some volatility. It's kind of boring, at least for now. But are you positioning into longer dated type of options? Are you in the sort of manic zero DTE side of things? Talk about what you yourself are doing.
So your dad is a very smart man, because he's correct when he talks about the time decay factor. So I like to flip that around and use the time decay in my favor. So I'm selling a lot of options, Michael. I'm selling puts, selling put spreads, selling call spreads, using the volatility, even though the market volatility is low, which generally speaking, when market volatility is low, it means that options are cheap as well too. But we're seeing a lot of options that are expensive right now. I want to take advantage and sell some of that premium and allow myself an opportunity to take advantage of that time decay. That's kind of what I'm doing right now. I'm selling, if I'm bullish, I'm selling put spreads, because smaller moves, like we've seen more recently with Amazon and Google, for instance, they're creeping up there. But it's killing the call buyers, because you're not overcoming that decay. It's beautiful for a put seller or a call seller, because they're able to take advantage of that and letting that market decay those options one day at a time. When volatility starts to move to the downside, that's a beautiful thing. Especially when you get these market moves to the upside and volatility starts to decline, you get that total decay on those options. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
A lot of your work, I'm going to assume, is kind of education driven on trying to get people to think about options trading correctly. Just given your experience in this, do you get a sense that we're in a period where more and more people view options more like a way to gamble and get rich quick? Or has that always been sort of a dynamic with options? Yeah, what I'm trying to get to is the sentiment kind of more skewed towards that than ever before?
Yeah, you know, I'm seeing a lot of, heavy risk takers coming in. And you know, when we had this, the CBOE created these zero date to expiration options. I mean, that's, pure gambling right there, Michael. If you want, you don't need to get your fix on gambling by going to Las Vegas. You could just use these zero dated to expiration options, like the SPY and the QQQ. They all expire. There's expirations every single day of the week, so you can get your fix of doing that. I think I like to look at options trading as a way to manage risk and to there's some risk involved, but you know what? I mean, we're not going to get paid if we don't take some risk. What do they say in baseball? You can't steal second with your foot on first, right? So you've got to take some risk and put yourself out there to try and make a decent return. But by the same token, you don't have to take stupid risk by, just putting yourself out there and saying, okay, look, I'm going to, I want to hit a home run. I'm going to put a whole lot of capital out there, and let's see what happens when you really have no control over what the market is going to do. And I think that there's a lot of people out there, Michael, who are there's a term in poker called if you're on the rails, which means you're out of the game. You're not at the table, you're on the rails, which means you're outside looking in, you're watching and you're not playing. So I think there's a lot of people who are out there on the rails watching what's going on because they've taken some stupid risk and they thought, well, okay, well, this is going to be my home run here. And they ended up losing all their money. So I think that's certainly a risk out there. I think most people, as you alluded to earlier, the options trading or stock trading, it's a journey, not a destination, right? You want to be enjoying the journey while it's happening in front of you.
Is a lot of the options trading that you focus on that you do stock specific, or are you doing it on broad ETFs, indices?
Yeah, so mostly I'm kind of equal opportunity. It doesn't matter, whatever, if it's an ETF, this index, the SPY, or a QQQ. I just bought some IBB calls the other day, Amazon calls. So individual stocks as well too. You know what? It's about being able to identify what type of a market condition are we in. Are we in a market of stocks? Are we in a stock market? And this market of stocks means that we're in a relatively good stock picking environment. We're in a stock market. We're going to get beaten around and tossed around regardless of whether our analysis on the charts or on the fundamentals are strong or not. The markets are going to go down. We're all going to go down. So I think that by and large, you know, you have to be able to identify the type of market that we're in. And right now, we're in a stock picking market, stock pickers market. And if you're able to identify the stocks that are going to move for you, you can make some good money playing options.
Shared at the top, then Twitter has to tweet to one of your pieces, protecting your portfolio from a stock market crash. Two things on this. One is, given my own years in terms of content creation, there was a period where I was one of MarketWatch.com's top writers. One consistent dynamic when it comes to content creation is the moment you put the word crash in a title, it tends to get a lot of attention. The first point I want to bring up is, do you think that word is overused in the media?
I agree. Yes, it is. It is really overused because it's just an attention getter. It gets people's eyes looking at it and ears open. Oh my God, because people identify crash with disasters, right? And they think to themselves, oh my gosh, what if the market's crashing, or if I'm in a car crash or something, that somebody's going to get hurt. And usually when you think about a market crash, people want to be prepared for it. You can't ever prepare for these things unless you're in there some of these doomsday investors or traders. But by the time they finally get it right, they've burned off so much money, they're never going to, by the time they get it right, you're kind of numb to what they're doing anyway. So I do think that the word crash is overused. I used it only because, people at the time were kind of looking for something to happen like that. And I think the point of the article was that don't look for a crash. But if the markets do happen to come down significantly, there are ways to protect yourself and make some money.
All right, so let's hit on that point. So I always go back to, when you look at studies on car crashes, right, most people hit the brakes after the crash. So that's why, to me, it's always about identify the conditions that favor the accident and then slow down and prepare accordingly. The old Peter Lynch line is that, more people have lost money waiting for a correction than in a correction. My response to that is, that's only true if you're shorting, and that's only true if you're in cash, because you can play asset classes like gold, like treasuries, that on average, can allow you to wait for the correction, but maybe still have a chance at compounding. But what were some of the things that you kind of alluded to in that piece as far as ways of protecting, in advance of a crash?
Well, I think using options are the ideal way to protect yourself, Michael. And I think using put options, I think that's something that people pretty much shy away from. I don't. I use put options every single day. I'm always have put protection on, especially in a bear market. When we're in a bull market condition, I tend to have put options on fewer times, because in a bull market, you're going to have some more forgiveness when the markets go down. If your positions are going down, you'll be forgiven more, and especially mistakes will get forgiven. Mistakes will get punished more in a bear market than they are in a bull market. But I think using put options to protect yourself in a portfolio is absolutely paramount. Also, selling calls against your stocks. There's a lot of investors who have big profits, say like an Apple. They've been holding them for 5 or 10 years. They have huge profits on those things. Stocks aren't going to go up straight to the sky forever. It's been going up for a long, long time. And, it's been taking a lot of people who've been short Apple out to the woodshed. But, still, you can be prudent. You can take some risk off the table. I'm always about trying to take risk off, Michael. I'm always trying to, alleviate my risk. I'll give you an example. Like, so yesterday, I was in some Baidu calls. I knew they had earnings coming out this morning. And I actually had a nice day yesterday, made some profits on the thing. And I'm looking to take some risk off the table. So I sold some upside calls against the long calls for exactly what I bought. So I had completely taken my entire risk off the table, but I still had a play working into earnings. So that's the sort of thing that I was trying to the message that I was trying to send in that article. Take some risk off whenever you can, and protect your portfolio with using puts. We did have some of the markets baking in either a pause last month or the month before, and possibly even rate cuts coming in. I think the market is quietly and slowly trying to get off of that position right now. We haven't seen big increases in volatility, after those moves happen. So remember something about volatility here, that volatility rises based on uncertainty, right? And so as that certainty becomes more clear, and once we understand that, yes, rate cuts aren't going to be coming, that uncertainty is removed. And even though bond prices are going to drop and we're going to see yields going back up, I think that in and of itself is not going to create too much volatility in the markets. We haven't seen it yet. So we'll see how it goes later on this year.
If the market is being held up because of the Fed futures side and bets around cuts, and the Fed does what it historically doesn't do, which is doesn't follow the market, that's sort of a realization moment of, holy shit, they're serious about higher for longer, and a lot of things maybe then have to be reevaluated.
That's right. And, you know, and of course, the next month's meeting in June, we're going to have another set of projections. And we heard yesterday and Friday that some of the Fed speakers, and even more recently from Chair Powell, the last rate hike meeting beginning of May, that a recession is not in their forecast. Rate cuts are not in their forecast either. So we're going to see where some of these Fed governors and economists shift and change in the middle of June to see where they're at that point in time. And I think that we do have another jobs report coming out at the beginning of June. We have another couple of inflation reports coming out in the beginning of June before or during that same week that the next Fed meeting is going to be. So it'll be interesting to see where their forecasts are. I think the forecast for GDP in the second quarter, Michael, is 2.7%, according to the Atlanta Fed GDP. So that's pretty strong, right? Coming off of 1% in first quarter, they're looking for a strong growth number in second quarter. And I think that if that number comes in, and we'll find out in July if that's true, I think that's pushing the market, the economy away from a recession, not towards it in 2023.
What would be your biggest piece of advice for those in the audience now, those that are listening? You know, I think FinTwit is, I'd argue, very, very dangerous as a place to try to assimilate information. A lot of good things, but also a lot of very, not just wrong things, but outright, you know, silly lies around the way investing works. But your experience, you've done the media rounds. So what's your biggest piece of advice for people that are listening?
Be careful who you're listening to. I think people, if they would start listening to you, I think they'd probably make better choices. But that's just that's just my opinion. I think you have to be careful who you're listening to and choose wisely who you choose and do some work on your own and learn and get better every single day. I think that I've been in this business for a long time, as you have as well, and I don't think there's any stop to the knowledge you can gain every single day. I'm learning something new every day. I know you are, and trying to just get better at what I do every single day is so important. And it comes from listening to the smart people, listening to the right people who have the information, who are going to help me make better choices and better decisions. So I think going forward, just do that. And don't forget to experiment. I think experimentation, not with drugs, but experimentation in the markets is certainly a good thing. If you get out there, and even if you lose money, and it's not a fun thing, it's kind of painful to do, but it's part of a learning process. You know, when you shoot baskets, you're not going to shoot three pointers like Steph Curry every single time you get out there on the court, but you're going to miss some shots. So, but if I think that that's so important to be able to follow somebody who's good and experiment a little bit as well.
I don't know, man. FOMO is a hell of a drug. FOMO can gives you a dopamine hit, just like a lot of other illicit substances. You can argue. I mean, I'm with you. I mean, you know, there's no better way of learning than to do, but you got to make sure you're not taking too big a hit. And I use that wording in a lot of different ways.
Well, I think what you're saying about FOMO is interesting because what is the one thing that we can never get back? And it's time, right? So if you're sitting there waiting for an opportunity, for a chance to get yourself back into the markets, get back into the game, you're losing time. And I think people get frustrated and they get nervous and they get worried. That window of time is closing on them, and they're not going to be able to get that opportunity to get in there. And all of a sudden, you're going to find that oh my God, Meta was 120 in January. Now it's 240. Oh, where was I? Oh, maybe it's, you know, I'm sitting there, you know, with FOMO, realizing that I've missed all this opportunity in 2023, just as one example for one stock. So what am I going to do? So I think that whole time element, because you can't get that time back. That's 6 months. You're not going to get that back anymore. But you always have the opportunity to look forward and do some good things going forward.
Where do people find some of your research, some of your thoughts and work in general, Bob?
Yeah, Michael, I'm created my company called explosiveoptions.net. I have a lot of content on there. I've been producing a lot more content more recently. I have the chart of the week coming out every Wednesday. That's on YouTube. You can find me on YouTube. I'm also I also have an amazing chat room with some 250 brilliant people who are in the room every single day. I really look forward to going there every day. You can sign up and it's pretty cheap. It's inexpensive. I'm not going to say cheap, it's inexpensive. To come into the chat room, you get ideas from me and from everybody else in the room and so forth. And we have a spread trading product as well too. I'm all over realmoneyinthestreet.com. I'm not sure if you know that when I was, I do write some articles over there. And you know, like I said, you mentioned earlier about Fang when I was writing stuff for Jim Cramer for his show, you know, for about 10 years over there. I haven't done it in a long while. He hasn't called on me for a while, but that was a great experience working with him. But and I'm also on Twitter like yourself, and you know, putting some good information out for people so they can learn.
That's a good place to wrap this Twitter space up, folks. I have another Twitter space in about 8 minutes. I'm going to prep for real quick, and hopefully I'll see you all then. Thank you, Bob. Really do appreciate it.
Michael, thank you very much for having me. Take care.
Cheers, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.